Jules Isaac was born in 1877. For the first 63 years of his life, he was a Frenchman by nation, culture. He was a classicist and historian by profession. He was a skeptic, an agnostic by theology. And he was a Jew simply by chance of birth. His grandfather had fought in Napoleon's Grande Armée. His father was a French career officer. His son is today an admiral in the French fleet. Monsieur Isaac had no reason to believe that he was not completely accepted. In his career, he rose step by step in the education ministry until in 1936 he became the Inspector General of Education for France, a post which is roughly equivalent to that of the United States Commissioner of Education. This man whose life was so tangential, the Jewish life, was still somehow destined to play an interesting, if minor, role in our contemporary Jewish history. It was Hitler who brought this Jew in out of the cold. When Hitler first appeared in Europe, Monsieur Isaac, along with most other French intellectuals, looked upon him as the arch enemy of all civilization. He looked upon the plank of anti-Semitism, of racism, on which Hitler rode to power as simply the aberrant prejudice of a few paranoid individuals. Then France fell. Professor Isaac's wife, daughter, younger son were trained off to Auschwitz. And Monsieur Isaac somehow fled to Vichy, France. And there he met up with all of his old friends and fellow bureaucrats and fellow teachers. And to his shock and to his dismay, he heard the very words of prejudice and hate spewing from the lips of men with whom he had worked in what he believed was complete amity and fraternity for almost 40 years. Isaac had to confront the simple truth that anti-Semitism is a widespread prejudice and that few, in Europe at least, were free of its poison. Shortly after the war, this man who had believed that anti-Jewish feeling was simply the insanity of a few went on to write, "There is a Christian anti-Semitism that is always alive and active, consciously or unconsciously. It can be said without danger of error that the great majority of Christians or those who are recognized as Christians, are outspoken anti-Semites. Even among the best Christians, and including many who participated in general against Nazi anti-Semitism, we can find traces of an anti-Semitism of a subconscious nature." These are harsh words, and this is a broad and bitter indictment. But Europe in those violent years of the Second World War gave ample proof that this testimony was in fact, fact. There has grown up since the end of the Second World War a myth designed to exculpate and pardon millions of Europeans for their complicity in the German enterprise. And the myth is to the effect that anti-Semitism was the prejudice of a confused, perverted Nazi few. That it was an artificial creation, a political platform designed by Nazi leaders to make the people forget their own domestic failures. Now, if this be true, that anti-Semitism was artfully conceived for its political value, it remains still to be explained why it was conceived. And the answer is self-evident. Anti-Semitism was put forward because it was a popular program. Anti-Semitism was used as a political weapon because it was the people as a whole were receptive to the stereotypes and the poison and the hate which Hitler spewed. The ground had been well prepared. What had prepared the ground psychologically and emotionally? Isaac came to the conclusion that the church teachings, the catechism, commentary, preachings, were largely responsible for what he called l'enseignement du mépris, the teaching of contempt. Anyone who can recall in his youth at 5 or 6 when a child of the same age turned on him and taunted him as the Christ killer will know exactly what Monsieur Isaac had in mind. But there is, of course, nothing that is unique or unusual in this statement. Many had understood the implicit complicity of Christian teaching in the phenomenon which we call anti-Semitism. Professor Isaac, as a historian, went on to see if he could understand the mechanics of this phenomena. And he went on to search for some solution, some way to spare Europe another outbreak of violence, viciousness, hate. And he came to the rather unique conclusion that this teaching of contempt was not part of the authentic teaching of the church. It was not reflected in the basic documents of the church, that is, in the New Testament, in their scriptures, but was, in fact, a subtle brew of commentary which had been built onto that original teaching and which had subtly but inevitably misdirected and misconstrued the original teachings to reflect anti-Jewish hate. And he called upon the church to return to the original documents, to cleanse itself of its complicity as an accessory before the fact in the phenomenon of anti-Semitism by teaching a doctrine which was pure in the classic meaning of the word, which was pure in that it went back to the original roots of Christian teaching. Now, Mr. Isaac wrote voluminously after the war in this field, and most of his volumes would have remained dusty and bulky on the shelves of few libraries. If the church itself, or to be more accurate, if a number of soul-seared clerics had not been terribly disturbed by what they had seen of the church, of Christians, and of Christendom before and during the Second World War. For decades they had, and generations and millennia, they had taught the gospel of love and saw this gospel of love transmuted into the words of violence and the acts that are vicious and vile. They had taught men to love thy neighbor as thyself, and they had seen men spit on their neighbor and elbow the Jew off of the sidewalk and drag him through the streets, the camp. And these soul-sick clerics had been chagrined and shocked by the silence of their church. And they had been chagrined and dismayed by the institutional predispositions of the church, which seemed more determined to sustain itself, to hold fast, to hold on to its property and to its wealth, rather than to stand up against governments which stood for all that was evil in the world. These men were saddened by the church's complicity in anti-Semitism. And they understood in some way how the teachings of the church had contributed to the stereotypes which had fed the fires of hate. And they read Mr. Izaak's books, and these books seemed to offer to them a way of opening windows, of letting in fresh air. We will return the Christian doctrine to its original roots, and no longer will the church be the seedbed of anti-Jewish hate. Mr. Izaak's books were sent on by some of his French clerical friends to the Vatican. They were read there. He had a meeting with Pope Pius, a vague, rather meaningless meeting. Then some years later, he had a far more interesting and important meeting with Pius's great successor, John the 23rd. John the 23rd, when he had been Cardinal of Milan, had been one of the few high churchmen in Europe actively to act in defense of the Jews in his territory. This aging Christian mystic had, by the very discipline of his soul, raised himself beyond the institutional horizons of Italian Catholicism. He saw the need of making the church stand for virtue rather than for the Vatican, for institutions and for ideas rather than institutions. He saw and he understood the complicity of the church in the violence of anti-Jewish hate which had spewed forth upon Europe. Shortly before his death, he is reported to have spoken a prayer which included these words: "We are conscious today that many centuries of blindness have cloaked our eyes so that we can no longer either see the beauty of thy chosen people nor recognize in their faces the features of our privileged brethren. We realize that the mark of Cain stands upon our foreheads. Across the centuries, our brother Abel is lain in the blood which we drew, or shed tears we caused by forgetting thy love. Forgive us for the curse we falsely attached to their name as Jews. Forgive us for crucifying thee a second time in their flesh, for we knew not what we did." John the 23rd, as Pope, brought the Second Vatican Council into being as a political function to open up the church to its ethical and religious responsibilities in the century. And he saw in Mr. Izaak's proposal an opportunity to clear up once and for all church teaching. He felt instinctively that if the church were returned to its root teachings, it could not preach hate, or at least it could not prepare the soil in which psychologically the seeds of hate grew. And he summoned into the chamber another elderly churchman, Augustin Cardinal Bea, the head of the commission which was designed for the promoting of Christian unity. And he told Bea to prepare such a schema for the first session of the Vatican Council. Both of these men were convinced the task could rather easily be done, as they understood Christianity, Catholicism, was after all the teachings of love, and all that they intended to accomplish was to make the church bespeak these teachings. But this program, so easily suggested, proved to be the most difficult and indeed impossible stumbling block before the Vatican Council. What John proposed, many of the traditional and orthodox theologians on the commission preparing material for the conference disposed. Such was the opposition to this schema when it was first presented by a number of traditionalists within the church, many of whom revealed in their speeches a rich tradition of anti-Jewish feeling. Such was their opposition that it could not be presented to the council at its first session. Only the intercession of the sick and ailing Pope saw to it that any proposal on the Jewish question was resubmitted to the Second Council. But again, there was such a furor by churchmen from Arab lands, by churchmen with anti-Semitic attitudes, by churchmen who had somehow come to believe that the traditional legends of the church were in fact church teaching, that nothing came of this second proposal and it was returned to the drafting commission. And then Pope John died. And this man of great spirit was followed by a man of very narrow spirit, the present Pope, Paul IV, whose concerns are largely those of the institution rather than of the great ideals for which it stands. And under the leadership of the Pope, of the new Pope, a schema was drafted for submission to the third session of the Vatican Council, which in effect did little more than repeat all the old traditions on which the teaching of contempt is based. The Catholic historian of the Vatican Council, Xavier Rhine, spoke of this schema with this very simple sentence: the sponsoring of the bastardized text was probably Pope Paul's greatest single mistake, if mistake it be. But very shortly after he submitted this new, unenlightened schema to the council, Paul arose on a Passion Sunday in a church in Rome and said, that people, the Jews, predestined to receive the Messiah who had been awaiting him for thousands of years, when Christ comes, not only does not recognize him, but opposes him, slanders him, and finally kills him. By this time, the schema on the Jews had acquired a symbolic value in the deliberations of the council. They could not pass such a document as Paul proposed. At least they could not pass it and continue that public relations to the world which insisted that the Vatican Council was a statement of brotherliness and fraternity and of common concern with other peoples and other faiths. And led in part by a number of American clerics who had caught something of the vision of Pope John, this Pauline schema was reversed and returned to the drafting commission. And at the fourth and final session of the Vatican Council, the original schema, in a much compromised form, was finally passed. Even in that compromised form, one prince of the church in eight voted against it. And John Coakley, the Catholic reporter on religious news for the New York Times, made this succinct comment: the never-ending controversy over the Jewish statement in the council has already blunted its intended effect. It was meant to be a word of love and friendship. It has already been the source of bitterness and disappointment, a reason for shame and anguish on the part of many Catholics, and of suspicion and rancor on the part of many Jews. What can be said of the finally promulgated schema? Will it open windows? Will it clear the air? Will it see to it that the old canards and stereotypes are not repeated to yet another generation of Christendom's children? Little can be said except that it is so narrowly drawn that unless the priest or the presiding bishop is of the spirit of John, that large, great, unusual spirit, there is every reason to believe that the old teachings will continue in an attenuated form to be taught. There are so many neverthelesses and despite it alls in this schema. The very simple statement of the brotherhood of our interests, our shared faith in God, loses its impact. And those who want to split verbal linguistic logs and logic in order to maintain the old-fashioned prejudices will, I believe, find every opportunity to do so. How shall we judge this schema? Julijczyk suggested that there are three main areas in which the commentaries and the catechisms of the church tended to influence what he called, as I indicated to you, the teaching of contempt. The first area had to do with the proposition that the dispersion of the Jews, the diaspora as we call it, was a direct responsibility for our involvement in the crucifixion and was in fact punishment for that involvement. Jesus apparently was crucified around the year 30 of the Common Era. In the year 68 of the Common Era, the Jews in Judea rose in rebellion against Rome. After 3 years of bitter fighting, this rebellion was squashed, Jerusalem was razed, the temple was destroyed, and the church went on to teach succeeding generations that the destruction of Jerusalem and the dispersion of the Jews was punishment by God. That God had ordered that because of the Jews' complicity in the crucifixion, they were to be endless wanderers upon the face of this earth. They were to wear the mark of Cain upon their foreheads, to be known as pariahs, wanderers, outcasts, and treated as such. A contemporary Jesuit manual says it very simply. Jesus had foretold it. The Jewish people was to be scattered. The Christian tradition has made no mistake about this. It regards the dispersion of Israel as a divine punishment. Having rejected Christ in order to save their country, the Jews had been rejected from their land, and their persistent non-assimilation in the midst of other races remains the indelible proof of their providential punishment. Now, what does the schema say about this tendentious history? The Jews, it writes, should not be represented as rejected or accursed by God, but it adds the qualifying statement as if it followed from history, as if it followed from Scripture. What if it follows from history? What if the catechist chooses to make the seemingly deceptively simple analogy, the crucifixion in 30, the destruction in 70, God's punishment, the dispersion? What if he forgets to tell the children that the original dispersion of the Jews occurred not in the year 70, but almost 800 years before, in the year 722 before the Common Era, when Sennacherib led off the 10 tribes of Israel as exiles into Babylon? Augustine Cardinal Bea, the man who piloted the schema on the Jews through the Vatican Council, a gentleman, has recently written a book called The Church and the Jews, in which this gentleman continues to insist that the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 was a direct result of the act of the Jews in sponsoring the crucifixion. So he goes on to make it clear that he speaks not of all Jews, but only of the Jerusalem Jews. But the connection is still there in the minds of the church. And as long as that connection is there, as long as the Jew is seen as the endless wanderer, I'm afraid that despite the simple sentence, the Jew should not be represented as rejected or accursed by God. That legend of the wandering Jew, that assumption of the cursed Jew, will in fact remain an effective one. The church indeed has a very simple way of remedying this teaching of contempt if it wishes to do so. By a simple diplomatic act, indeed only recognize the state of Israel. The Vatican is one of the few governments in the world today which refuses adamantly to recognize the new state. Why? Because to recognize that the wandering is at an end, that the punishment has been concluded, even in their theological terms, would be to go against this teaching of contempt, this assumption that the punishment was God-ordained and is endless. And by showing that its unwillingness to recognize the new state, the church shows with actions which are louder than words that it is not yet broken with the ancient teachings. When Pope Paul visited Israel just 2 years ago, Not only did he come in through the back door, but he refused to cross through the Mandelbaum gate because that was an official Jewish State of Israel point of entry. Not only did he refuse to come through the official Jewish point of entry, but never in his 3 days in Israel did he refer to the State of Israel, but only to the Holy Land. The second area which Isaac conceives as the seed ground of the teaching of contempt has to do with the teaching that by the time of Jesus, Judaism had degenerated into a cold legalism. We were a fossilized relic. The spirit which had infused the prophets had been drained from us. And we were only the followers of a law which we no longer understood. We obeyed God out of fear and not out of love. You've heard all of the phrases. I've spoken to you in many of these last weeks about some of the great Pharisaic teachers, about Hillel, about Akiba, about Rabbi Meir, about these men of grand spirit and profound wisdom. Let me read you how a manual published by the Sisters of Bernadette describes the Pharisees. The Pharisees are hypocrites. Their religion is farce. They overload the law of God with countless minutiae and elaborate rites. But underneath, their hearts are full of pride, ambition, and malice. Now, what does the Vatican schema say about this second teaching of contempt? Here it is most hopeful. Since then, the spiritual patrimony common to Christians and Jews is so great, the Council wishes to foster and commend mutual understanding and esteem. This will be the fruit above all of biblical and theological studies and of brotherly dialogue. No longer is our religion a farce. No longer are we spoken of as people who follow countless minutiae and simple elaborate rites, whose hearts are underneath full of pride, ambition, and malice. But there is a recognition of the vitality and the maturity of Judaism. But how far does that recognition go? The very schema which the Vatican Council passed insists throughout, again and again, on the one church, on the true faith, on the right of the church to missionarize any and all. It shall not be forgotten that only the Catholic Church has the right and the duty to evangelize. The reunion of the Jewish people with the church is part of the Christian hope. Eagerly in following the teachings of the Apostle Paul, the Church expects in unshakable faith and with heart and desire the entrance of the people into the fullness of the people of God established by Christ. Now, the dialogue which the Church proposes is really not a dialogue after all, but a monologue. And the confrontation has within it an element of affrontation. They will recognize us up to a point. But beyond that point, there is only one way, one truth, one holiness. I'm afraid that as long as this arrogance, this ecclesiastical arrogance remains dominant in the teachings of the church, so long will it remain difficult for the church to accept the vitality and the responsibility and the wisdom of any other faith. And though the words change, and though the Pharisees may no longer be tendentiously categorized and castigated, nevertheless, it will be difficult for the child, for the average Catholic, to see the beauty, the grace, the insight, the fullness, the wholesomeness of any other approach to religion. And the third teaching of contempt to which Mr. Isaac points has to do with the charge of deicide, Christ killer. Originally, the Vatican Council schema submitted by John deplored and castigated the teaching of deicide. In the final document, the very word was omitted. In recent church manuals, you'll find such phrases as these. The vengeance of God will fall without mercy on the deicide people. Or again, this murderous people, eternally nailed up to the crossroads where the descendants of mankind meet and intercept. Now, deicide is a logical impossibility. God cannot die. And if God dies, he dies willingly. And even within Christian doctrine, God dies for this, to free man of the burden of sin. He dies as a free will offering for man. And of course, the New Testament history is highly suspect. It was written many decades after the fact and written for many reasons which had nothing to do with an accurate newspaper historical kind of report of the facts themselves. Are these simple statements made in the schema about the Jews? No. What is said is simply this. True, the Jewish authorities and those who followed their lead pressed for the death of Christ. Still, what happened in his passion cannot be charged against all the Jews without distinction then alive, nor against the Jews of today. The ancient identification of the Jew as the principal element in the murder of the Christ remains, but it's circumscribed. Not all Jews of that day, and not the Jews of today. One wonders what the average Catholic peasant will make of all of this logic splitting. And here we come to the root of the problem. Isaac's proposals to the church and the church's acceptance of this structure is basically false. As long as Catholicism rests on the foundations of a fundamentalist understanding of the New Testament, so long must some kind of paragraph, such as the one that the schema finally promulgated, be in fact proposed. As long as the church looks upon the New Testament as a literal statement of historical truth, so long must the Jewish people be implicated in the death of Jesus, whether there is any historical foundation for that fact or no. Isaac set the church on a task which, in fact, the church could not continue. For it is the New Testament, and not the later manuals, and not the later commentaries, which insist upon the responsibility of the Jew for the murder of Jesus. I read to you from the Gospel according to John. Jesus was led into the governor's headquarters. It was now early morning, and the Jews themselves stayed outside the headquarters to avoid defilement so that they could eat the Passover meal. So Pilate went out to them and asked, "What charge do you bring against this man?" "If he were not a criminal," they replied, "we should not have brought him before you." Pilate said, "Take him away and try him by your own law." The Jew answered, "We are not allowed to put any man to death." Pilate then went back into his headquarters and summoned Jesus. "Are you the king of the Jews?" he asked. And Jesus said, "Is that your own idea, or have others suggested it to you?" "What, am I a Jew?" asked Pilate. "Your own nation and their chief priests have brought you before me. What have you done?" And Jesus replied, "My kingdom does not belong to this world. If it did, my followers would be fighting to save me from arrest by the Jews. My kingly authority comes from elsewhere." "You are a king then?" said Pilate. Jesus answered, "King is your word. My task is to bear witness to the truth. For this was I born, for this I came into the world, and all who are not deaf to truth listen to my voice." And Pilate said, "What is truth?" And with those words went out against the Jews. "For my part," he said, "I find no case against him. But you have a custom that I release one prisoner for you at Passover. Would you like me to release the king of the Jews?" And the clamor arose, "Not him. We want the bandit Barabbas." Pilate now took Jesus and had him flogged. And the soldiers plaited a crown of thorns and placed it on his head and robed him in a purple cloak. Then time after time they came up to him, crying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and struck him on the face. Then once more Pilate came out and said to the Jews, "Here he is. I am bringing him out to let you know that I find no case against him." Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple cloak. "Behold the man," said Pilate. And the chief priests and their henchmen saw him and shouted,
Crucify, crucify, take him and crucify him yourself, said Pilate. For my part, I can find no case against him. But the Jews answered, we have a law, and by that law he ought to die, because he has claimed to be the Son of God. When Pilate heard that, he was more afraid than ever. And going back into his headquarters, he asked Jesus, where have you come from? But Jesus gave him no answer. Do you refuse to speak to me, said Pilate? Surely you know that I have authority to release you, but I also have authority to crucify you. You would have no authority at all over me, said Jesus, if it had not been granted you from above. And therefore the deeper guilt lies with the man who handed me over to you. From that moment, Pilate tried hard to release him. But the Jews kept shouting, if you let this man go, you are no friend to Caesar. And any who claim to be a king is defying Caesar. When Pilate heard what they were saying, he brought Jesus out and he took his seat in the tribunal. It was the eve of Passover, about noon, and Pilate said to the Jews, here is your king. And they shouted, away with him, crucify him. Crucify your king, said Pilate. We have no king but Caesar, the Jews replied. Then at last, to satisfy them, he handed Jesus over to be crucified. It is there in the New Testament. To satisfy the Jews, Jesus was crucified. Now, of course, this story was written maybe 80 to 100 years after the events. It was written specifically to remove from Rome the onus of having been the government which crucified the Christ, because the conversion activities and missionary aims of the new Christian movement were directed towards the Romans, and they wanted to free the Romans of any onus, of any guilt. But it is there. And as long as the New Testament is looked upon by the church as the literal revelation of God, the exact truth, so long will it be impossible for the truth, for the church, effectively to expurgate the teachings of contempt. Let me conclude with two observations. The first has to do with what has become one of the games people play, the game of dialogue. It seems that every time a Jew and a Catholic and a Protestant get together, they have to have a theological dialogue. Now, the Jew is often, in this case, like the sheep led unto the slaughter. He remembers dimly a phrase or two from his Sunday school education. But he never had the 12 years of catechism, the explicit training required of every Catholic. Why? Because in our tradition, the teachings and the people and the practice and the history are all one. There's really no separate area called theology, which can be blocked out, in which truth can be verbally and neatly described. Now, what is the problem with dialogue? In the first place, it's generally an exchange of ignorance. In the second place, the Jew quickly finds himself way over his depths in Thomist philosophy, in St. Augustine, in texts which deal with ideas he vaguely appreciates but doesn't quite understand. And the Catholic quickly finds himself exposed to a liberalism which he can only label humanism and therefore atheism and therefore outside the pale. And let it be remembered that the name of the game is still baptism. The dialogue, as the church conceives it, is permissible only up to a point. At the end of church activity is still the mission and the acceptance of the Christ. There is reason for a serious study of all faiths. But parlor conversation is not serious study. If you want to understand Catholicism or any other faith, go to the library. Pick out the classic texts written by their writers. Involve yourself in it. You will learn, you will understand, and you will appreciate. And if those who want to learn of Judaism want to learn, they have only to come to our library. And we can give them a reading list which will keep them busy for many a year. But let them learn that which is true and accurate. Let them learn, get a whole understanding of the tradition, and not just your particular understanding or misunderstanding of it. You know, you can cooperate in this world without being privy to the theological privacies of another human being. And that is my second point. That though I find little that is comforting in this schema theologically, that the Catholic still lives in a Thomist, medieval, fundamentalist world which my faith long since outgrew, though I am still concerned that the Church will seed the ground in which anti-Semitism grows despite the fine language in which the schema is phrased, I nevertheless find in the Council and in its pronouncements openness. The statement, we do not want the Catholic Church to be any more a nation apart, a people interested only in their own preservation. We know now, as do all peoples, that it is only by the united concern of all men that war and poverty and injustice, etc., can be remedied. I only wish that the openness with which the Catholic in their documents found it possible to confront the Eastern religions, they had found it possible to confront our religion. Listen, for instance, to the way in which they dealt with Islam. In the course of centuries, there have been indeed many quarrels and hostilities between Christians and Muslims. But now the church exhorts everyone to forget the past, to make sincere efforts for mutual understanding, and so to work together for the preservation and fostering of social justice, moral welfare, peace, and freedom for all mankind. Fine, simple, straightforward. Let the past be forgotten. Let us maximize our present social concerns. But with the Jew, the Church is tortured, indrawn. There's not a note of the mea culpa that was in John's prayer. You know, forgive us for the curse we falsely attached to the name of Jew. Indeed, time and again in the schema, they find a chance to point out to our defects. As Holy Scripture testifies, Jerusalem did not recognize the time of his visitation, nor did the Jews in large number accept the gospel. Indeed, not a few opposed its spreading. The past is not forgotten. It is very much alive. This is not the Messianic age. Jews cannot live with the happy innocence that other generations in Christendom will grow up without having been taught the teachings of contempt. But there is great hope that we can little by little learn to work together in common cause for justice, for righteousness, and for peace. There are many within the Church who desire it. There are many within our faith who desire it. And these ought to be the areas of meeting and of dialogue. But of theology, leave it to the theologians. Dialogue, leave it to those who are skilled in the art. Some years ago, the High School of the Temple attempted a dialogue with one of the Catholic schools. A youngster spoke bravely of the social vision, the prophetic tradition. The Catholic youngster spoke subtly and skillfully of the elements of Catholic teaching. As I listened to these two groups of young people, I realized that they lacked even the same language. To one religion was a theosophy about God, to the other religion was a mandate about life. To one religion was a truth which was firm and fixed, to the other religion was a truth which was outer-directed, visionary, but non-specific. One knew exactly what his faith demanded of it. The other sensed only the basic drive towards virtue. There was no meeting, there was no mingling, there was no greater understanding after that meeting, except my own recognition, which I'm trying to share with you this morning, that we can be friends and neighbors without engaging in theological dialogue, that we can be citizens and effective citizens without opening up to one another the confused gray area of our own spiritual lives. That is not the way. The way is one of action and of social concern. Amen.